Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
With the New York Times in one hand and the Catechism of the Catholic Church in the other, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence.
America is as divided as it has been in 150 years.
Politics is symptomatic of the culture.
They don't have a personal relationship with Christ.
We've been sacramentalized, but not evangelized.
Why should Washington listen to us when our own house is in disarray?
The church's greatest riches are her people.
Share the contagious joy of being a friend of Christ.
Story after story after story of people who have had inexplicable healings.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and taking a closer Catholic look at current events, issues, and ideas. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
That's beautifully said, Al.
Thanks for your voice for liberty.
It's like a homecoming each time on your program. It's
clear to me that you've thought these things through at a deep level.
Let's build the church, and then we'll bless the nations.
And a very good afternoon, and welcome to Cresta in the Afternoon. I am, as you have gathered, not Al Cresta. I am, however, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, senior contributor with EWTN and also a senior editor with the National Catholic Register, with the privilege of being with you for the next couple of hours, trying to fill in for Al. Of course, he cannot be replaced, but I'll do certainly my level best to help. Well, there has been a tsunami of stories related to the current sex abuse crisis, and it seems at times that it is understandably pushing everything else out of the way. But even as a crisis unfolds, it's important to note that at the same time, some stories that we should remember, especially as they are so key to defending the dignity of the human person. I'm speaking especially, of course, about abortion and euthanasia. We're going to be talking with an expert coming up this hour on euthanasia. And then we're also going to be visiting with a good friend of mine, Dr. Paul Thigpen. We're going to ask the question about those saints who stood up to corrupt clergy. Who were they? What do they actually offer us today in the face of our own crisis in clergy and the need for reform in the church? And then in the next hour, we're going to get a lot of news updates. As I said, the news simply does not stop coming, does it? We're going to get updates on the most recent news for today, including the meeting at the Vatican with Pope Francis, so the leaders of the U.S. Catholic Church, of course, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, as well as Archbishop Jose Gomez. We also have more news about Cardinal Donald Wuerl and what will his fate ultimately be. And then we're going to get another update on what's happening on Capitol Hill from Jason Calvi of EWTN News Nightly, their redoubtable Capitol Hill correspondent. And then we're also going to talk with Brian O'Neill, an expert in the saints, who's going to give us a little walkthrough of the stigmata and the role of St. Francis in that. But first, news headlines with Dan McGraw.
Thank you, Al, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Thursday, September 13th. It is the Feast of St. John Chrysostom. And today's news is brought to you by Charity Mobile, supporting pro-life and Catholic causes at CharityMobile.com. Cardinal Daniel DiNardo said today's meeting between Pope Francis was lengthy and fruitful. Also at the meeting were USCCB Vice President Archbishop Jose Gomez of Los Angeles, USCCB General Secretary Monsignor Brian Bransfield, and Cardinal Sean O'Malley of Boston. The meeting follows a series of calls for Pope Francis to release files held on Archbishop McCarrick. While the statement did not specify if McCarrick's case or Vatican files related to it were discussed during the meeting, DiNardo had previously called for greater transparency by church authorities on matters of sexual abuse, and especially that case of Archbishop McCarrick. An archdiocesan spokesman has confirmed Cardinal Donald Wuerl will soon ask Pope Francis to accept his resignation as Archbishop of Washington, D.C. In a Tuesday letter, Wuerl said he would soon meet with the Pope, but did not specify that he would ask to be allowed to resign. As requested by canon law, Wuerl originally submitted his resignation upon turning 75 in 2015. The outer bands of Hurricane Florence are beginning to rock the North Carolina coast. Right now, Florence is a Category 2 storm with sustained winds holding 110 miles per hour and gusts at 130 miles per hour. The slow-motion storm is expected to be a major flooding event, and authorities are warning about deadly storm surges and possible mudslides to parts of the Carolinas and mid-Atlantic states. When Florence will make landfall is not clear, but it's expected to happen in the next 36 to 48 hours, probably in North Carolina. And now with your fascinating fact for the day, the amount of concrete in the Hoover Dam could build a highway from New York to California. Filling in for Nick Tom, I'm Dan McGraw with your Ave Maria Radio News.
I always say that I love filling in for Al for no other reason than because of the great music that they have on this show. Well, one of the terrible realities of the church scandals is that the voice of the church in wider culture has been crippled on a host of issues at a time when secularism and the culture of death have taken hold in so much of the West. Witness Ireland, where same-sex marriage and abortion have been unleashed as the church's credibility has been demolished in so many ways by the scandals. One issue that we need especially to monitor is euthanasia, and ground zero for some of the most worrisome developments is Belgium. I'm joined by Wes Smith, a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism and a consultant to the Patients' Rights Council. His new book, Culture of Death, The Age of Do-Harm Medicine, is out today, and we'll be discussing the book. Find his writings at First Things in National Review. I love what he's been working on, especially regarding this very issue. Welcome, Wes.
Hey, Matthew. Good to talk to you.
Well, this is one of those topics that has been percolating for a long time. We've had the Death with Dignity movement. We had the Hemlock Society. First, for those who may not be that familiar with this whole movement, where are we in culture with euthanasia?
It depends on where we are, where you live. There has been a really concerted drive to legalize killing or suicide as an answer to human suffering, good grief, since the late 1890s, we'll say. It started getting going in the 20s and 30s and then fell back, and then it's really been, the new movement has really started since, we'll say, the late 80s with the Hemlock Society. You have an awful lot of people who are buying this hemlock idea, this poisonous idea. And I think when you mention Belgium and the Netherlands, you can see where it can lead. Netherlands and Belgium and Canada and Luxembourg have legalized lethal injection euthanasia. That is, doctors commit homicide when patients ask for it if they qualify. And in those countries, it's certainly not limited to the terminally ill. Indeed, in the Netherlands and Belgium, mentally ill people can be euthanized, are euthanized, and making things even worse and more disturbing, euthanasia in those countries is conjoined with organ harvesting. So you have had actually written up in respected organ transplant journals depictions of mentally ill people brought into a hospital, hooked up to a line, killed, wheeled into a operating theater, and their organs removed. And Matthew, I can't think of anything more disturbing or dangerous to a mentally ill person who may be having trouble getting through the night because of their agony than letting them think that their deaths have greater value than their lives. That could easily become a tipping point. You have people with disabilities who are euthanized in these places. You've had elderly couples, joint euthanasia killings in Canada that I know of, plus in Netherlands and Belgium, and sometimes not because of illness, but because of fear of future suffering, in other words, widowhood. Here in the United States, you've got assisted suicide legalized for the terminally ill, that is, doctors giving a lethal prescription if they come to the conclusion that a patient has 6 months or less to live. By the way, sometimes these patients have lived for 2 and 3 years to show you how inaccurate that designation can be. But that's legal in Hawaii, California, Oregon, Washington, Colorado, and Vermont, and District of Columbia. And then there's a dispute over Montana because of a court ruling. Australia, the state of Victoria, has legalized assisted suicide for the terminally ill. So that's about, oh, and Switzerland has suicide clinics, just to show you how cute this can get. What fun. You fly into Switzerland in business class and you fly home in the hold, right? Germany has a court legalized it as long as there's not some kind of a monetary exchange. So that's where we're at the moment. Most places, of course, still resist the effort to legalize. The UK, for example, most states in this country have had concerted efforts to legalize that have failed. So we've been fighting the fight.
Well, by way of just so people can understand just how expansive this has become. If we look at the numbers for euthanasia in Belgium, death by legal euthanasia has increased tenfold. That's 982% from 235 in 2003, the first year in which it was fully legal, to 2,309 in 2017. And I mean that is a pretty astonishing number.
It's gone up in every state where it's legalized, because the more people get used to it, and the media is really working overtime to normalize this. Every couple of weeks there'll be a story about a going away goodbye party, a suicide party, if you will. It's really disturbing. And in Belgium, by the way, they've done away with all age restrictions. And there was a story out recently based on Belgian statistics that were published. Three children have been lethally injected as young as 9 years old. And in the Netherlands, even though it's not technically legal, it happens without consequence under what is called the Groningen Protocol, Groningen. They kill babies in their cribs born with terminal conditions or serious disabilities. Infanticide occurs in the Netherlands. And the Netherlands calls itself a civilized country. I don't think so.
Yeah, can we add into that even the sort of search and destroy movement that we've seen, for example, in Iceland against down children?
Yep.
So the question that leaps to mind immediately is, why are they so focused on sort of the eradication of children? What are they hoping to accomplish with that?
Well, it's not the idea of eradicating children, but it is the idea of a utilitarian mindset that says that suffering is the greatest enemy. And in fact, eliminating suffering justifies eliminating the sufferer. And then once you get to the idea that eliminating suffering by killing is an acceptable answer, then what causes the suffering quickly expands. As I mentioned, the geriatric joint euthanasia killings, sometimes of people who weren't seriously ill at the time but are worried about future grief caused by widowhood. And you've even had advocacy, the idea that, for example, there was a medical journal article in the Netherlands that said that one justification for infanticide of a seriously ill baby would be the suffering of the parents. Mm-hmm. So we'll put the baby out of the parents' misery. And then you've also had talk in the euthanasia movement, certainly by Derek Humphrey, used to be of the Hemlock Society, which, by the way, is now a gooey euphemism title called Compassion and Choices. And he said that a real unspoken argument, that was his term, for allowing euthanasia and assisted suicide is the cost of health care. Because when you get down to it, what could be a cheaper, quote, treatment, close quote, than euthanasia or assisted suicide? It might cost, let's say, with doctor visits, $1,000 to kill somebody or assist their suicide, while it might cost $100,000 to make sure that they get the kind of interventions so they don't want to kill themselves anymore. I mean, the consequences and the implications are really profound.
What's your take on this recent movement of people who are throwing parties for themselves as they take their lives?
I find it reprehensible in a couple of ways. First, that the media would celebrate it, because that's promoting and glorifying suicide. You know, the World Health Organization has media guidelines, and they to try, because suicide is a communicable condition. There are a lot of copycat suicides. Mm-hmm. And so they really urge media, when you're reporting on suicide issues, to be very, very careful, for example, not to glorify the deed, not to really describe in detail what happened, how it happened, and so forth. But when it comes to assisted suicide, the media throws all those aside, and they push it, because they really, a lot of the members of the media really believe that this is compassion and that this is, quote, choice, and that this is the humane way to go. And they buy the death with dignity nonsense, as if my father, who died of colon cancer, didn't die with dignity. It's an insult. Secondly, and this is something that I've just been running into recently, when you have somebody saying to their family members, you have to be with me when I kill myself, that is, to me, not a loving thing to do for a family member, because you really put that family member in a terrible conundrum. If they say, okay, it's your choice, maybe the person's killing themselves because they're worried about being a burden. Well, you're confirming, yes, you're a burden, Grandma. Or maybe they're killing themselves, and I'm not just throwing out these descriptions out of my hat, because this is from the statistics why people do this. Maybe they're worried about not being as lovable as they once were. I mean, Brittany Maynard, the most famous assisted suicide, she's become the cover story or the cover photo for assisted suicide. She said when she had brain cancer, she had one of the reasons she did it, even though she didn't try hospice, was she was worried about her own suffering, which we could all understand. But the second reason was she didn't want her to be remembered poorly when her family saw her go through decline. Well, that's a really frightening thing when you consider it. And so if you say, well, okay, yeah, you're right, Grandma, it probably is the best thing for you to do. You're telling her, you know what, I won't remember you as well. Or Grandma may think, well, you know, I'm worried that I will lose dignity. Well, when you say, yeah, you should commit suicide or it's okay, we're fine with that, it's your choice, you're saying, yeah, you know what, you will lose dignity. And it's a terrible thing. But it also, if the person says, no, I don't want to be part of that, you know, those, I call it social martyrdom. People who are, for example, your audience, a mainly Catholic audience here, they could get a call from Sister Sue in California saying, you know, Grandma wants assisted suicide Tuesday. We want you to come. Mm-hmm. What does your audience member do? If they go, they validate it, as I mentioned earlier. The Catholic Church, I would say, if you did that, would consider it probably to be a serious sin.
I think that would be
but
safe
if you
to
don't
say.
Go, if you don't go, Sister Sue might say, how dare you push your Catholicism down our throat? How dare you judge Grandma? You're out of the family. You could end up with a terrible family discord and breakup over this very volatile and very provocative and really controversial issue. To ask somebody to come to your suicide, to me, is not a loving act.
No, it's not.
It may be based in fear, but it's not a loving act.
Well, I would encourage everyone to go to nationalreview.com to read your recent piece on promoting rational elder suicide. I think you make a great point that September 10th is World Suicide Prevention Day. I used to call the annual event you write Invisible Suicide Prevention Day because it is so often ignored in major media. But you also make the point that but perhaps we should change that name to World Prevent Just Some Suicides Day. A mere 5 days prior to the big event, two columns were published in major newspapers that, at the very least, you write, present elder suicide in a sympathetic light. Well, thank you so much for giving us this update. This is a horrifying subject, and we can't lose sight of it.
Thank you, Matthew, for caring about it and for having me on.
Wesley Smith, when we come back, I talk to Paul Thigpen about great lay saints who brought reform to the church. This is Crest in the Afternoon. I'm Matthew Bunsen, filling in for Al. Welcome back to the Cresta in the Afternoon show. I'm Matthew Bunsen, filling in for Al. Delighted to be with you today. It's a difficult time in the life of the church. There's no question about that, that this is definitely a moment of crisis. And if there is any consolation, however, to those of us living through this time, it is that we have dealt with crises in the church before and in every era. Faithful Catholics have helped the reform process. They pushed for renewal at all levels of the church. What makes these extraordinary men and women particularly important, though, and this is why I'm so eager to talk about this topic today, is that they did so without calling for revolution in the church or abandoning the teachings of the church. Quite the opposite. They've called for the faithful to be what? More faithful. To love the church even more. Who were a few of these great reforming lay people, and what are some of the ways that we can emulate them today? Well, I'm joined by Dr. Paul Thigpen, a good friend of mine, an award-winning journalist and the best-selling author of 45 books, including Saints Who Battled Satan. Paul, welcome.
Thank you, Matthew. Great to be here, buddy.
Well, I always love just being able to talk to you in general, especially about saints and, of course, your great knowledge of theology and the history of the church. But this is a topic I think that's very relevant to where we are today in the life of the church. Would you agree?
Oh my goodness! It's it's one of the reasons I did my degrees in church history is that I learned. I guess it was an ancient Greek philosopher who once said that history is philosophy teaching by example, And I like to adjust that to church history and say church history is theology teaching by example and morals and a whole much, you know, a whole bunch of else. And so, when we get in situations like this, that one of the first things I always do is turn to church history and see what we can learn from that.
So what other eras in the life of the historical church would be close to this moment? I know everyone considers this particular moment that they're living in the most important one, and this is in no way to downplay the immensity of the suffering of the victims here. But in the 2,000-year history of the church, we have actually dealt with similar problems, haven't we?
Well, we have. I think the era that comes to mind most readily was the period that St. Catherine of Siena lived in, because she herself as a layman was such a remarkable, important reformer. So we're talking about the 14th century, the 1300s, where there was corruption at every level, especially at the higher levels of the church, corruption by the clergy, both moral and, having to do with sexual morality, but also with political maneuvering and misuse of finances and so many other ways. You have periods, of course, too, like the period that led up to the Reformation, one of the reasons why Luther and so many others got so upset with the church, though sadly they left. You even have periods, maybe not so much with immorality, but also with heresy, like right after the Council of Nicaea in 325. There was a period there when the majority of the bishops went Arian and were terribly persecuting the faithful during that time who held to the creeds of the church. So we had periods that have been pretty serious.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the Arian heresy, because it's one of those fascinating realities that at a time when so many bishops were heretics who adhered to the Arian beliefs regarding our Lord, it was never really embraced, Arianism, I mean, by the vast majority of the Christians of the Roman Empire, was it?
It wasn't. And you get a wonderful summary of this by Blessed John Cardinal Newman. He has a place where he just kind of, you can get it in the book called The Newman Reader, but where he, paragraph after paragraph, he gives examples of reports from that period. You have a few of the, you know, the teachers and bishops who have been faithful, but in many places, like in Cappadocia, St. Basil talks about the year 372, that because most of the clergy at that time there had gone with the Arian heresy, that they raised such a ruckus that they couldn't be resisted. They would, instead of meeting in the churches, they would meet out in cemeteries or out in the wilderness, wherever they had to. And other places, their protests could not be ignored. So it's pretty amazing. I think it's probably right to say that the church was able to remain orthodox through that period by God's grace, working in the laity, primarily in the laity. You had a few champions like St. Athanasius, but mostly the laity.
Well, and that that relationship that Athanasius had with his laity, you read his letters that he wrote, enjoining them, encouraging them, exhorting them. And at one point, I know his own faithful saved him from arrest and probably worse from one of the Roman emperors, didn't they?
They did. And they themselves, I mean, that's because the Arian heresy was also adopted by the imperial court for the most part. Then you had the power of the Roman emperor behind the Arians who were trying to take over the church and had taken over a good bit of it. So you get these just horrific reports of some places of what actually happened to the faithful if they would resist. Some of them were put to death. They were beaten terribly. They were imprisoned, all kinds of things. But they insisted, no, this is the truth and we'll die for it. It's a great story about a group of the faithful who are going to be occupying a basilica there in Milan with St. Ambrose. And the troops were coming, and the word had gotten out that the troops were going to come and probably kill all the faithful there. And there's a story told there that an older woman with a little child by the hand was running really quickly toward the basilica and running through the troops. And they stopped her and said, "Don't you know what's about to happen? Why are you running toward this trouble?" And she said, "We're both going to be martyrs." Just remarkable, remarkable faith, remarkable fortitude.
The courage that it takes to push for reform in the church when that reform is needed, but also to stay faithful to the teachings of the church. We're hearing a lot of people today who are understandably very upset, very angry at what's been happening. But there isn't there this tendency either to walk away or to try to come up with solutions that really will not solve the problem and will damage the church manifestly. So for those who are looking to lay people in the past, especially these great lay saints who stayed faithful in these times of crisis, what's your starting point? What are the things that we look for by way of their characteristics or attributes?
Well, courage, you know, of course, first they great courage in declaring the truth, even when it's going to be costly to them. But even as an underlying thing there, before that, more fundamental, is their faith, that they really know their faith, they're confident of their faith. So many times I'm, you know, hearing people right now that if they're kind of suggesting, well, maybe I'll just leave the church over this or that kind of thing, they don't always have this kind of strong conviction of what the church is, and especially, say, the Eucharist or other things, that if you don't have this anchor of solid faith of what the church is, what the graces of the sacraments are, that despite all this other stuff, that the reality is still there, it's very easy for a storm to come along and kind of, you know, press you away. And that's not to, you know, cast aspersions on the motivations of all the people who are being tempted right now to leave. But I think the better you know your faith and are convinced that it's true, that the less likely you are to give in to the temptation to just throw your hands up and walk away. So for that, that's one of the most foundational things. But then there's got to be the courage. There's got to be unity. I think one of the things I'm seeing in some parishes right now is, and even beyond that, the enemy's strategy seems to be to take the faithful Catholics and to divide them over smaller issues or smaller aspects of the issue, instead of standing together and saying, no, this must change. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to be careful about that as well.
And isn't there a temptation to walk away from the sacraments? I've heard from a few people on different radio shows I've been on that, their form of protest is, I'm just not going to go to Mass anymore. And that strikes me as probably the last thing you should do.
Of course, it's like finding out that your doctor is not that he's a quack, but that he's maybe taking money on the side or doing something like that, or even that he has an immoral life, and then say, therefore, I'll stop taking my medicine. The sacraments we need so dearly, we need them so much. We need confession, we need the Eucharist, we need all the others. And so it's in a situation like this, you don't run away, you know, from the trouble, you run to the church. So for me, that's the great place of consolation. And these last few weeks, I've of course, like so many people, grieved and angry and confused in certain ways. And yet where I find my greatest consolation, strength and clarity is when I'm in church. That's where I'm finding it. And it may be in a holy hour. It may be during Mass. Maybe when we're singing one of the great hymns of the faith. But that's where I'm finding the consolation that I need and the strength.
And so for those who would say to you, and I know you deal with people who are very unhappy right now, who are spiritually in desolation, as lay people, what's the first step that you give in terms of advice? So you say, okay, pray, go to Mass. What else can you tell them?
Well, you know, a lot depends on their particular circumstance. If they're, you know, a lot of us probably need some time to forgive. We need to know that we need to forgive. That's a hard thing to say. It sounds like you're defending the offender, but you're not. That if we allow bitterness to get a hold in our hearts, of our hearts, that it'll destroy us, it corrodes us. That we have to, now forgiveness doesn't mean here that you don't want to see justice for the offenders, that you do, but that in your own heart that you let go of the offense and give it into the hands of God, because otherwise it'll just eat you alive, it'll keep you awake. It did that to me the first few nights when I started hearing about this kind of thing, and I finally realized, at a certain level, I have to let go of this and hand it over to the justice of God. Mm. But then trying to, you know, encourage them. I mean, if I talk to someone who's who actually has a loved one that's been abused, that's a whole different thing, you know, from, or at a whole different level of care than just someone who's, who's angry, you know, over the cover up or something like that. But I do tell the guard, you know, you got to forgive. You've got to, as an act of faith to the Lord, say, Lord, despite everything, you're in control. You are purifying your church. You're going to bring good out of this, even though it seems nearly impossible right now. I've just got to trust you in all this.
Yeah. Well, let's leave it there for the moment. I know you're going to be we're going to be able to continue this conversation, so don't go anywhere, please. You're listening to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Matthew Bunsen, filling in for Al. We'll be right back with a lot more from Paul Thigpen. Welcome back to Cresta in the Afternoon. I'm Matthew Bunsen, filling in for Al today, continuing my conversation with Dr. Paul Thigpen, who is the author of, I think it's 45 books, right, Paul?
Well, 50 now.
50. Good job.
Yeah. Well, you've probably got more. If I know you, you've probably got more than that. So.
A few, but it's not a competition. As I always joke,
yeah, who's counting, right?
Right, exactly. I always joke that I go for quantity over quality.
That's great. Oh my.
So we've been talking about the role of laity in bringing reform to the church, and we have seen a lot of reform movements in the history of the church that have gone horribly wrong. I'm thinking of the Cathars and others. For those who are thinking of how to live this as a movement, what are some of the things that you look out for that could be perilous for your own moral life, your spiritual life, and the health of the church?
Yeah, I think about St. Francis, who eventually was ordained a deacon but never ordained a priest and lived so much of his life as a layman, and how much the church was in need of reform in his time. And how much reform was accomplished by, you know, the Lord working through that man. And you, when I ask myself, what is kind of what's the defining characteristic of a Francis? And I think it was humility. And maybe that doesn't seem so relevant right now when people are, you know, wanting to shout out at the Pope or the Cardinals or whatever. But, the big pitfall, I think, in trying to lead a movement like this is a kind of pride or self-righteousness, that we, as we criticize, as we challenge, as we condemn the behavior, though not the people, you know, don't render them to the judgment, to a judgment of hell, but have some hope for them. We've got to make sure we don't allow in an attitude of ourselves that we are the final judge of everything. Or that we know things that we can't really know. We don't have the ability to know what's always going on in the hearts of some. So, I would just say that's one of the first things that we've got to try to maintain an attitude of humility. Some of the other pitfalls, I guess you know, the mercy and justice are always seem to be presented as opposites or something in competition with each other, but I think they're two sides of the same coin. God himself is perfect justice and perfect mercy, and in him those two perfect things coincide, so that we can't allow the perception to creep in that somehow mercy is going to do away with justice or justice do away with mercy. I don't know if that makes any sense or not, what I'm trying to say, but I've heard just recently even of a bishop talking about, well, we've got to be merciful and all these things. But you can't let mercy mean, and therefore we won't bring justice to those who've been so terribly damaged.
Mm-hmm.
That those two things have to be kept together in any kind of reform movement. And also the truth. We've got to say the truth is so important that, as in anything that has, you know, political ramifications, whether it's politics in the country or politics in the church, we have to remember that truth that we're after. And if the truth kind of goes contrary to what we were expecting of certain individuals, well, so be it. You know, if we had someone who was a hero and the truth is showing that not really so much of a hero, then we have to admit that. If the truth is showing, an accusation is true, we've got to go with it. If the truth shows investigation and the accusation was not true, then we don't want to just look for a decision or an outcome that we're already hoping for or already convinced of. We've really got to get at the truth in these things.
In looking at the history of the church and great crises, one of the recurring things that you see is the interference or the involvement of the lay power, of the secular power, or Caesar. We had positive outcomes from time to time. For example, I think of Pope Leo IX, who helped spark much of the reform that became known as the Hildebrand Reform, because he brought in Hildebrand, who became Gregory VII, and all this beautiful atmosphere of reform that included, of course, the great saint and doctor of the church, Peter Damian. But sometimes that didn't turn out very well. I think of Martin Luther, who was embraced by the German princes. And there are those who today are saying, well, let the attorneys general do their job, which is absolutely fair, but let them bring reform to the church because, as the argument goes, the bishops have abdicated that. Historically and sort of even theologically, what are the great risks of having a secular power involved in trying to reform the church?
Well, you know, I think the main issue here is that you could throw 100 bishops just to grab a number in prison because of certain things that are breaking the law and the moral. But does that reform the church, or does it simply purge and cleanse some portion of it? Reform has got to come from the inside. Reform. So I agree with you. Let the government do its job, especially since so many within the church have fallen down on it. But we can't expect the government really to cause a reform in the church. The government can purify certain areas, can bring things to light. But it's, the president himself wouldn't be able to cause a reform in the church. It's got to start with the hearts, our hearts, and then the hearts of those who are leading the church. And that's a much more difficult task, of course.
It is. And somebody who was something of an expert at that was Catherine of Siena, a doctor of the church, a saint, a mystic, but somebody who seemed to really have her finger on what was needed for reform. What were some of the things that she was calling for, especially with regard to the papacy?
Well, at that time, the papacy, the Pope and his palace, so to speak, had been relocated to Avignon, France. And that was a political thing that had to do with political maneuverings of cardinals who were French and influenced by the French king. And so it was a big mess. But basically, Rome had an absentee pope, was living in France. And this went on for 70 years. Great scandal throughout Christendom. And St. Bridget of Sweden, actually, before St. Catherine, had openly called for a reform. That is kind of a place to start the reform, because it wasn't just that he was living in the wrong place. It was that the papacy was being unduly influenced in many ways by politics of the day, the secular politics of the day. She began calling for that relocation. It didn't happen. But then after she died, St. Catherine took up that mantle. And that's just one of many that she took up. But calling on the Pope, she went to, by the time she had a great international reputation as a mystical woman of great holiness and wisdom, she went to Rome to talk to the Pope himself. She would write letters to the Pope and finally convinced him to move back to Rome. And when he faltered, would write him a letter, and it's almost comical. You read the letter, oh my goodness. She called him my sweet babu. But then her words were very strong. She said, I beg of you on behalf of Christ crucified, this is to Pope Gregory XI in 1376, that you not be a fearful child, manly. Open your mouth and swallow down the bitter for the sweet. So in other words, she's in the imagery. It's like a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. This is bitter medicine. Take the bitter along with the sweet, because that's what's got to happen. And she says, I prayed and shall pray to Jesus that he free you from all servile fear and that holy fear alone remain. Let the fire of charity be in you in such a way that it will prevent you from hearing the voice of incarnate demons. That's pretty strong. People who are speaking for the devil. Heeding the counsel of perverse counselors who want to alarm you, tell you you'll die. She says, get up, Father, and act like a man. Wow.
Very strong language.
Yes, very strong language. And finally, she did prevail.
Well, and one thing too about Catherine is that the popes themselves realized what they had on their hands. Instead of banishing this person who's saying these things to them, they accepted it. They understood where this was coming from. And even someone like Urban VI, who, because of his intemperate personality, because of some of his rash judgments, helped create the environment that led to the Great Western Schism that divided the church from 1378 to 1417, and at one point there were three claimants of the papacy. And yet he brings her to Rome and tries to set her to work, and then has a great comment to the College of Cardinals that had assembled there, that look how we tremble and she is firm. So is that a demonstration too of the way that the leadership of the church can recognize the important role that laity can play in a reform?
I sure hope so. You know, I mean, just we've got to see it. There's just been so many times when the laity were the ones that, you know, brought about the change. And sometimes I think it requires, you know, an intervention of God of some kind. I think about how the deal with Francis, where he comes to the Pope and wants to establish this movement for reform, and everybody in the court's against it. He kind of dismisses them, and but then the Pope has a dream from God in which he sees the church falling down and little Francis there holding it up to keep it from collapsing. And by God's intervention, he kind of calls Francis back in and says, I think you're supposed to do this. I mean, it's almost a funny kind of thing to think about, that I could just see that what people were thinking of Francis that night. But
but isn't there also that
I'm
great image?
God intervene.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And but isn't there also that great image of Catherine, that she had a dream herself of the bark of Peter crushing her, as though she understood what the cost was going to be for working as hard as she did to bring reform to the church? And is there a lesson in that for us too, that we have to be willing to give ourselves on behalf of the church, not to save the church from herself, as some people say, or to bring a revolution to the church, but by giving ourselves truly, and to use that word that you did, humility, in humility, to work for the church?
It's going to be costly. It is costly already for so many. I know some courageous priests who have been speaking up to their bishops, and I wonder, you know, what their immediate future will be like because of that. And yet they know they've got to lay it all on the line. They've got to call for the right thing to be done. They're justice as well as mercy. See, of course, you know, Catherine called on for a lot of other things too. So you read
she
her
did.
Dialogue. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Well, Paul, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you so much for being with us today. Stay tuned. I have a few final thoughts. This is Cresta in the Afternoon. My thanks again to Paul Thigpen. I'll be right back. Thanks again to Dr. Paul Thigpen for his beautiful reflections on the role of the laity in authentic reform. I'd like to encourage everyone to take a couple of minutes and read the Code of Canon Law. I know that sounds sort of absurd, unless you're a canonist, but I would say start with Canon 224 and just read what follows. It's the obligations and rights of the laity. It's something that's often overlooked by lay people in the life of the church, that you have certain rights, but you also have a lot of obligations. And one of those, as Paul was saying, is to love the church. Catherine of Siena loved the church and was one of the greatest reformers in the history of the church. We need more saints, and that means all of us. that universal call to holiness that the Second Vatican Council talked about, that Francis de Sales talked about, that the Church has always talked about. This is our moment, then, as Catholics, to be faithful, to be holy, to love the Church, and to help reform the Church. And we're going to continue this discussion regarding the current state of the Church and this crisis. Coming up in the next hour, I'm going to be having some, what I hope are very interesting conversations with Ed Condon of the Catholic News Agency, who's going to give us an update on all of that, the reporting of the meetings today in Rome, as well as Jason Calvi of EWTN News Nightly, who's been covering very closely here in Washington, D.C., the entire story of Cardinal Donald Wuerl. And then we're going to get an update as well about the current state of affairs on Capitol Hill, as well as the likelihood of the passage of the approval of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to be the next Supreme Court justice. These are things that matter, so all of us need to stay well in tuned. So thank you so much for being with me today. It has been a joy to be filling in for Al. And one of the things that I really love about being able to fill in for him is working with the incredible staff here, especially Brian Shenley. But one thing other, too, is to be able to talk to you directly, to be able to sort of share some of my experiences. You can find me at ncregister.com. Matthew Bunsen filling in for Al Cresta. Thank you so much. Please stay tuned. We have another hour coming up.
This hour of Cresta in the Afternoon is co-produced by Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.